Could military units here on the First Coast be mobilized in a conflict with Iran? Good morning and Happy New Year. Thanks for starting off 2020 with us. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening this morning. Just ahead, we've got a packed show to start off the new decade, including reaction from a local foreign policy strategist on heightening tensions with Iran. You can join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, Cole Pepper on the Jaguars coaching staff, sticking around for another season. But first this morning, the streets of Tehran are packed at this hour as a sea of people turn out to pay their respects to Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian general killed by a U.S. drone strike last week in Baghdad. President Trump says the decision to kill Soleimani was based on intelligence that he was planning an imminent attack on Americans. There's no solid evidence to back up that claim. Iran has vowed revenge on the strike, and the president has responded by threatening to attack Iranian targets, including cultural sites. That is a potential war crime. So what can we expect next? Here on the First Coast, we've got a large military community watching these developments closely. Nancy Soderberg is a foreign policy strategist who served in the Clinton administration's National Security Council and also was a ranked ambassador to the United Nations. She joins us now with some insights into Iran. Nancy Soderberg, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Okay, so we have two major naval installations and military assets locally. Watching this closely, military personnel, along with civilians, want to know what we can expect next when it comes to Iran. What do we know at this hour?
Well, I think the one thing we know is that we're headed for an increased escalation with Iran. That means more troops deployed overseas, more uncertainty, and a unpredictable president that has vowed to retaliate against any Iranian escalation. So it's one of the tensest periods in the Middle East.
The killing of Soleimani could unleash unforeseen developments. We don't really know yet how this could shake out. But what's your reaction to the decision to assassinate him?
First of all, we don't know what precipitated this decision. President and his top officials have said that there was an imminent threat and they had to take him out in order to, quote, remove him from the battlefield. But beyond that, there's a lot of questions that have been raised. What was the imminent intelligence? This is the second most powerful man in Iran who's already been in place. Did taking him out actually disrupt any attacks against the United States or our allies? Or is it simply inciting more violence and putting a bigger target on the United States? Early indications are that it is doing exactly that. If you look at where we are a year after the United States pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, Iran is hell-bent now on breaking out of that deal, building a nuclear weapon. We have more troops in the Middle East. Anti-Americanism is up. We've handed Syria to the Iranians, and now we have just been voted out of the U.S. presence in Iraq. It's very hard to see how that makes the United States safer.
How will that affect our national security and the region more broadly as Iraq votes to essentially kick U.S. military presence out of its country?
Well, the vote was non-binding, so I think it's a protest vote that we'll see if the Iranians push for the Iraqis to move out. The Iran influence in Iraq is on the rise, and this makes the Iranian influence in Iraq that much more powerful. That said, if we pull out of Iraq, the Iraqis know that ISIS will continue to threaten them. Our allies, the Kurds, do not want us to leave. They saw what happened when we pulled out precipitously in Syria and left them to the massacres of the Syrian government. And so those types of questions are ones that it does not appear that the administration had thought about when making this decision. President was in Mar-a-Lago in between a lot of holiday and golf. And to make this decision, his top officials flew down. It's unclear how much consideration was given to the fallout of taking out the second most powerful man in Iraq. So we don't know where the Iranians are going to strike. They say they'll strike a military target. Does that mean they'll go after our bases, our weaponry, our soldiers, our embassies. We don't know. I think most analysts believe that they will strike. They've said that they've got 35 sites that they're looking at. The U.S. President Trump has said, okay, we're going to hit you back with 52, including cultural sites, which would be considered a war crime.
Right.
So it's all very unpredictable.
We're getting tweets from listeners pointing out that the U.S. is a party to the Hague Convention for the Protection of Cultural Property in the Event of Armed Conflict that prohibits reprisals against cultural sites. Such as the 52 sites, that's a reference to the Iranian hostage crisis. The 52 hostages Iran held that were U.S. citizens. The president threatening to attack 52 Iranian cultural sites. Walk us through why that is a serious concern.
Well, the history of war has evolved so that conventions to prevent the worst outcomes of previous wars, particularly following the massive use of chemical weapons in World War I and the devastation and the Holocaust in World War II, emerged a series of conventions that tried to lay down some code of conduct that would protect everyone's soldiers, protect the societies. And destroying cultural sites serves no military purpose and has been outlawed for decades. And so hopefully cooler heads will prevail in a different response. I think what the best case scenario that Americans could expect coming out of that is that the friends and allies in the region would try and de-escalate this. You've got Iran, Russia, and China aligned on one side in the Middle East, and us, the Saudis and the Israelis, and with some support from the British and French on the other. And I think what you're going to see after this protest in Iran, you've got hundreds of thousands of people out protesting the United States, you know, escalating threats from capitals in Tehran and Washington. And I think it'll kick it into the diplomatic sphere where Boris Johnson is going to get on the phone with Trump saying, tone it down. The Russians and the Chinese will do the same. And as we've seen over and over again, the president listens to Vladimir Putin. So what is he going to say to the president? So I think this is an evolving story that has unnerved both our markets. Mm-hmm. The price of oil is probably going to go up. And the Iranians, while they're a regional power, are no match for our military. They do have a million soldiers and strong regional power, the ability to hit our allies with their ballistic missiles in the region and target Americans very directly.
Let's bring it down to the local level. Talking to local commanders around the region, Mayport, NAS Jax, Fort Stewart up in Georgia, local military units could be activated if things escalate. What are your insights for members of our local military community and their loved ones?
Stay tuned. I think anything could happen. Right now, they've activated the 82nd Airborne to go out and help reinforce our military installations. At the moment, it doesn't look like we're sending massive naval power there, which would affect our more local families, but it is entirely possible. One of the histories of the Iran actions is to target ships in the Straits of Hormuz and the Red Sea, and that area which is crucial to the trade and particularly our oil trade. So if this goes really south and we get into a escalating tit for tat, then the naval forces will certainly be affected. I think most people feel that we can pull it back before we get to that, but this is a very unpredictable situation.
Reservists from the Army and Air National Guards in our area could potentially be activated as well. So you said it's an unpredictable, volatile situation. People who study and understand foreign policy, what I hear you saying, Nancy, is sincerely hope that de-escalation happens. What if it doesn't?
Well, then we're in for a war with Iran. And I think this president ran on trying to pull us out of the Middle East. He criticized the war in Iraq, Afghanistan, why are we over there? Let's get our troops home, has talked repeatedly about trying to pull our troops back. And I think that's his instinct. I don't think he wants to have a war with Iran, which is why this move was particularly troublesome. And I think it's important to recognize that when President Obama went after Osama bin Laden and President Trump went after the head of ISIS, Baghdadi, Those were decapitating, already crumbling, very lethal, but already crumbling terrorist operations networks. So we played a game of whack-a-mole with Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and it effectively destroyed those organizations from the major threat that they were. This is fundamentally different. We just took out the head of the Quds Force that is not a crumbling terrorist organization, but rather a very powerful one with the full backing of the Iranian government. So taking him out doesn't decapitate, but it has enraged 80 million Iranians and our friends and allies around the world. Israel is strongly supportive of it, but I do not believe that an enraged Iran makes Israel safer. So I think that we need to look at the impact on Israel. We need to look at the impact on our interest in Syria. Lebanon is controlled by the Iranian asset Hezbollah. They're now in range. So across that region, we've now going, I think, see a more unified Iran. We were hoping that the Iranian people would begin to insist on reforms there. That's obviously on the back burner now. So it's very hard when you look at where we were 5 days ago and where we are now to see that this strike made the United States safer. I think it has damaged our interest of our friends and allies and put Americans at risk.
Former UN Ambassador Nancy Soderberg, always great to get your insights. Thank you.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, really. And we will be right back. Stay tuned to us. Back in a moment.
WJCT and the Florida Theater present Canadian acoustic guitarist, composer, and producer Jesse Cook, performing live at the WJCT Soundstage on Tuesday, January 21st, 2020, at 8 p.m. Jesse Cook blends rumba, flamenco, and elements of new age and jazz to create his uniquely global sound. Don't miss the opportunity to see Jesse Cook live at the WJCT Soundstage. Visit WJCT.org/events for more information.
Welcome back. Well, it's a new year and a new decade. If you're planning to kick off 2020 by making those resolutions, we've got some advice on how to stick to them. John Chapelier of Changing the Focus, Inc. is also the author of The Daily Six. He has some thoughts on how to make positive change a reality in 2020. Hey, John, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. It's good to be here.
Okay, so you say success is the most powerful drug there is. So if we experience a little bit of success, that motivates us to keep going. It sounds great, but why do we have such a hard time making personal positive changes, and why do we always fall off by February or March?
Well, that's, I guess each person is a different issue. But for me, when I was trying to figure out how to make this work, the reality is that we are uncomfortable with change, and whether even if it's good change, you know, saving money, all of a sudden I don't have any money in my pocket, so I take the money back. Losing weight, getting in shape. I say, and sometimes in keynotes I'll say, you know, we make these resolutions, and if they're good for us and they're healthy for us, why don't we just do them? And the answer is because it's uncomfortable. And all new behavior is uncomfortable. So the key ingredient here is the consistency it takes to practice new behaviors until the uncomfortable becomes more comfortable.
You have a half dozen effective techniques to make permanent positive change. So right. What are your daily six, I guess?
Oh, okay.
We should call them.
The daily six are integrated with the idea of creating change. So the daily six are willingness, quiet time, love and forgiveness, gratitude, and action. And if I forgot one of those, I apologize. But that's the criteria. And if you think about it, I mean, when I do short talks Sometimes it'll be, I just talk about willingness and action, the willingness to take a step forward and the action to be committed to making that change, practice frequently enough to make it more comfortable. Quiet time I use simply as a mental reminder to keep bringing ideas of change up into your conscious mind. And I decided I was going to do this today. How am I doing with that? I used to have a, people don't wear as many watches anymore, but I used to have a technique where I pick a little green signal dot and put it in the center of someone's watch and use that as their trigger. Every time they looked at their watch, it was, I'm going to eat better, or I'm going to work out more.
A visual cue.
A visual cue.
So that can make, that can be powerful, can't it?
It can be very powerful. And the idea here is now, nowadays, I guess the idea is stick it on your computer or stick it on your iPhone or something else. But the more that you can keep top of the mind awareness of the changes that you've committed yourself to, the easier it is to stay with it. I've suggested that with dozens of people over the years that just continuing to go back and remind yourself frequently. One of the things I sent you was a little thing called 5-3-1-20.
And what is 5-3-1-20?
5-3-1-20 is a very simple but very effective technique for creating and keeping yourself focused on change. And it's 5 hours a year, 3 hours a month, 1 hour a week, 20 minutes every day. Reviewing whatever it is that you committed to in your 5 hours, recommit to it in three, and then recommit to it in one. And then what are you going to do today to move you towards that
20
goal?
Minutes a day. So if your goal is to lose weight, can you do 20 minutes a day?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's probably the most common resolution, but
it is. It is. But it's also something that we tend to, it's sometimes with eating especially, it's a comfort issue. And so when we're uncomfortable, we tend to do what makes us more comfortable. So if it's eating, it's eating. If it's a couple of drinks after work, it's a couple of drinks after work. And so those are really hard to create long-term change. But again, as you said earlier, the success is the most addictive drug. And I absolutely believe that because not a whole lot of people get a sense of what success feels like all the time. So just a little taste of that every once in a while is amazing as far as a motivational cue. The other component is to give yourself some quick wins. If I was trying to lose weight, the first thing I would do is I wouldn't say I'm trying to lose weight. I'd say I'm getting in shape. So instead of trying to move away from a negative behavior, it's much more effective if you can move towards a positive behavior.
And how do you apply these ideas to professional goals?
It's 5-3-1-20 actually started as a professional goal. It was a friend of mine in DC who had a small business, and he and I were trying to figure out how to keep him focused. I mean, you want to talk about ADD. I think he was the poster child for ADD in the 70s and 80s. And Rick just couldn't figure out how to do it, so we came up with this. And the more frequently it could be in his head, the more easily it was for him to be able to implement on a continuous basis. So really what you're looking for is permanent positive change. And that's the same, I mean, because that's what most of what I do is organizational. So the idea here is if you're sitting down and creating a one-year picture for your business or yourself, how often are you breaking that into segments, monthly segments, quarterly segments, you know, whatever it is. And that's why the 5-3-1-20 works so well. It keeps it in the front of the mind.
Very good advice for an individual, for an organization, for all of us. So thank you for helping us start the new decade with your daily six mantras and some good information we can all use as 2020 begins. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Melissa. It's great to be here and good to see you again.
You too. John Chapelier heads up Changing the Focus, Inc., and he's also the author of The Daily Six. Still to come, Cole Pepper with a look at Shad Khan's controversial move to keep his Jaguars coaching staff into the next season. But up next, why so many older Americans are having accidents behind the wheel and what to do about it. We'll be right back.
I'm Lindsay Kilbride, producer and host of WJCT's Oddball Podcast. Launching this new venture was honestly a risk for us. So if you want more projects like it, let us know. Contribute and shop the merch at oddballpodcast.com.
Welcome back. January is Glaucoma Awareness Month, and new research shows the importance of raising awareness about this degenerative eye disease. That's because glaucoma affects some 3 million Americans, and the National Eye Institute projects that glaucoma cases will increase nearly 60% over the next decade as baby boomers age. Now, a new study found patients with moderate glaucoma are at greatly increased risk of having a car accident. It's due to unnoticed visual blind spots that are part of the disease. Right now, we're learning more from Dr. Leah Kammerdiener of Florida Eye Specialists. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So this is Glaucoma Awareness Month, and I had no idea this many Americans were affected and that so many more are projected to be affected. Tell us about glaucoma.
Glaucoma is really the second leading cause of blindness globally. And it's estimated that almost 50% of people with glaucoma don't even realize that they have it. It's slowly degenerative, meaning it gets worse, and it affects the peripheral or side vision first. So it's very subtle, and people often miss the initial symptoms.
So what are the symptoms? How do you know if perhaps this is what you're dealing with? As you said, people might not realize that they're even dealing with this disease.
Sure. Really, there are not a lot of early symptoms. People often miss the fact that their peripheral vision is starting to become impaired. Sometimes it shows up in things like car accidents or feeling like people sneak up from from the side. But really, you don't feel it. You don't see it in your vision until it's a little bit more progressed. So early screening is incredibly important. And that's one of the things that we do at Florida Eye Specialists.
Right. You specialize in the treatment of glaucoma. We'll talk about that in a moment. First, though, tell me a little bit more about this study and the connection between glaucoma and car accidents, because this is pretty worrisome to hear that you expect a 60% spike in these cases over the next decade. Almost makes me not want to get out on the roads.
Absolutely. This was a 4-year study out of Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia that showed that in particularly even with just moderate glaucoma, almost a 10-time increase in car accidents. Because glaucoma develops so slowly and begins in the side vision, people often don't see peripherally. And of course, it's worth noting again that almost 50% of people don't realize they have the disease. By the end of the study, a quarter of the patients voluntarily gave up their keys. Mm. It is a permanent disease, which means when you give up your keys, that's giving up driving for life. So again,
right.
Prevention is incredibly key.
Yeah, seniors, of course, don't want to lose their mobility. And is it primarily senior citizens who are affected? Is it just a condition of aging?
So people over age 60 are certainly more at risk, particularly those who have a family history of glaucoma. We see it more prevalence in African Americans or people of Hispanic descent or in people who have a history of eye injury or who are extremely nearsighted.
What causes it?
So it's a buildup of pressure in the eye that squeezes the nerve behind the eye and leads to this peripheral or side vision loss. It's a tunnel vision disease. So again, it progresses slowly, but it can lead to blindness. It can get into the center vision.
So then what I hear you saying is if you even suspect a hint of this, get screened. Tell us about screening and early detection.
Sure. We recommend everyone over age 60 come in for at least an annual exam to get looked at for their risks for glaucoma. We do that by testing the peripheral or side vision. We do that by assessing the nerve, the part of the eye that can sustain damage. And if caught early, we have a lot of very good treatments in order to help prevent vision loss, to slow the progression of the disease.
How do you treat it?
So at Florida Eye Specialists, we generally start with things like eye drops, but there are very easy in-office laser treatments for glaucoma. And in some of the more difficult cases, there are many types of surgeries that we can do as well.
And that doesn't cure it, but it can lessen the effects, I guess?
So it certainly can slow down and even sometimes stop the worsening of glaucoma. The earlier it's caught, the better chances of sustaining good vision throughout your life. So again, it's very important for patients over 60 to get annual screenings.
Now, of course, patients over 60 are part of this population, but as I listen to you talk about glaucoma, I'm reminded of my late aunt, Janice. She was diabetic from childhood. She went blind. She had glaucoma because of her diabetes. Her juvenile diabetes eventually caused her to go completely blind, and her eyes became cloudy. It was really sad to see this progression of this disease. So I'm just curious to ask you, glaucoma can affect, in some cases, other patients too, right?
Absolutely. There's a very large array of eye diseases that can lead to glaucoma, as well as some systemic diseases, autoimmune diseases, for instance, rheumatoid arthritis. So really, even if you don't have the risk factors that I mentioned, I do recommend coming in for screening at a place like Florida Eye Specialist. It's part of the annual comprehensive exam. We look at all of those things, as well as assessing other age-related eye illnesses, such as macular degeneration or cataracts.
And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking about Glaucoma Awareness Month with Dr. Leah Kammerdiener of Florida Eye Specialists. A new study shows glaucoma-related car accidents are expected to increase 58% over the next 10 years. And you know what? Especially here in Florida, I think that's a concern, doctor, given that we have a large senior population. What advice do you have for people out there who have a senior in their life who's got the car keys? Or any of us, really? I guess drive defensively is basic advice.
Well, really, I think that people want to take care of themselves as well, because, of course, they want to protect their independence, and catching something like glaucoma early, we can help you do that. But also encouraging family members, friends, church members, et cetera, to get their annual eye screenings, to ensure their own safety, the safety of their family in the car with them, the safety of the people around them.
You can get your glaucoma screening right now by going to FloridaEyeSpecialists.com. January is Glaucoma Awareness Month, and 3 million Americans are affected, with many more expected to be affected in the next 10 years. If you feel like you're losing some peripheral vision around the sides, go get screened. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, author Michael Wiley, and then later, Cole Pepper, as the Jaguars coaching staff sticks around for another season. Don't go away.
I've been watching you for some time. Can't stop staring at those ocean eyes. Burning cities and napalm skies. 15
sound means you're in the Electro Lounge, where fresh, down-tempo, chill-out, and new jazz music plays Monday through Saturday nights at 9 p.m. only on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson.
Together, we host the Florida Roundup, a weekly live statewide call-in show looking at the biggest issues impacting the Sunshine State. If it's making news in Florida, you'll hear it on the Florida Roundup. So join us each Friday at noon, right here on 89.9 WJCT.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues. every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, First Coast author Michael Wiley has built a solid literary reputation over the years for his riveting mystery and crime novels. They feature narratives set both in his native Chicago and his adopted home of Jacksonville. Wiley's latest yarn is a brand new mystery series featuring Chicago private investigator Sam Kelson. He joins us now with more about his new tale, Trouble in Mind. Hey, good morning. Happy New Year.
Good morning to you. Happy New Year, Melissa.
Good to see you. I'm a big fan of your work because, like you, I used to live in Chicago. And like you, I used to follow the doings of the local police and the private investigators up there. You've written some great books set both there and here in Jacksonville. This new book features Sam Kelson, a private investigator in Chicago. Tell me about it.
Well, Sam Kelson is a detective unlike any other, but he's deeply enmeshed in kind of the tradition. When we think of people like Sherlock Holmes and a whole tradition of private investigators, very often they've got some kind of impediment that they're dealing with. Sherlock Holmes, you know, people have suggested that he might be kind of Aspergerian. He maybe suffers from depression or anxiety. I decided that I really wanted a detective who was going to be dealing with some kind of impediment that would make his job especially interesting. And so based upon an accident that occurs during an investigation when he's still a police officer, he suffers an injury that leads him to have something known as disinhibition. So he cannot help but to speak very often at very inopportune times. And he can't help but to tell the truth, which makes
his... He cannot tell a lie,
which makes his job really interesting, especially when he's, you know, trying to protect, say, the identities and the secrets of some of his clients.
So that does make his job a little tougher. So then what is the plot of Trouble in Mind?
Trouble in Mind, again, I love the old mysteries. I love the mysteries where somebody comes into the private detective's office and says, hey, I've got a problem, and we're going to be, you know, needing somebody who can handle this discreetly. So a woman comes into his office, and she thinks that her brother has been selling drugs illicitly as a pharmacist, over-the-counter, you know, dealing opioids. That's just the very beginning of the story. And as it turns out, she's more than she looks like. The mystery, the reason for her wanting to hire him is more than you might expect. And so it's a complex plot.
Yeah. And without giving too much away, it's certainly current given our opioid epidemic.
I always try to deal in some way or another with things that are going on in the news. And this one is not about opioids. It's very much about treachery and betrayal and revenge. But the basic news story is one that we've seen.
With no abating at all of people loving these types of stories. I mean, for example, the new movie Knives Out features an interesting private investigator trying to get to the truth of a murder or a death.
If people haven't seen Knives Out, you got to get out to the theater right away. Daniel Craig just kills it.
He just does a great job. It was so good. And his character of Benoit Blanc is probably going to be seen in another movie, which is what you do. You build a story around a character. And you take him through several books, right?
I do. This is my publisher has contracted for 3 books. This is the first of them. And after this, after Trouble in Mind, we're going to see Lucky Bones. And after that, a book called Head Case. And those will be rolling out over the next 2 years.
He's a busy guy. Well, local author Michael Wiley, if you're just tuning in, has a new novel out. It's called Trouble in Mind. And it's the tale of Chicago private investigator Sam Kelson. Can you read a little bit from the book for us?
Sure, I'll do just a couple of paragraphs. This is before he has suffered the injury that leads him to become a private investigator. He's still a cop. That January, a month before Sam Kelson took a bullet in the head, word came from a snitch that a kid on the northwest side was selling the best dope in Chicago. High grade, cheap, lines around the block until a cruiser turned the corner, and then a magic disappearing act. The kid looked 15, maybe 16. They called him Bicho, Spanish for bug. Bicho because he was little and skinny. Bicho because he scurried into a hole whenever a cop showed. That's the start. I can do a little bit more? Or?
Sure.
Okay, sure. The job went to Kelson. 8 years on narcotics, the past five undercover. Kelson always partnered with Greg Toselli. They went through academy together. Their careers paralleled so closely they could have held hands while riding down the highway on motorcycles. Not this time, said Darren Malinowski, commander of the narcotics division. Toselli's a hothead. Go it alone. Keep it quiet. See what it is. Why the special deal? Kelson asked. This is a kid. You've got a kid, right? A 9-year-old girl, Kelson said. Mine's 13, Malinowski said. Close enough. You know how it goes. If he looks like someone we can fix, let's take him off the street, put him in a program. You're soft, Kelson said. I like that. What if he can't be fixed? We slam him against a wall and break every bone in his little body, Malinowski said. Yeah, you're a marshmallow, Kelson said. A feather pillow, a dish of pudding. You always say what you're thinking, Malinowski said. If I said half of what I was thinking, said Kelson, I'd be divorced, friendless, and after a day or two on the street, dead. And of course, then he's soon after suffers an injury in which he does say more than half of what he's thinking.
How funny. How do you research your novels? You know a lot about how not only private investigators work, but also how they interact with police.
I love the research part, and I try to make everything as close as I can. So I've done ride-alongs with local police here. I've done a lot of work with Chicago police. I don't have a background in law enforcement myself, but I know a whole lot of people who do and spend the time that I can doing it. The other research is really, intriguingly enough to me, is into the form. You know, one has to know how the stories get told. So as much as you want to stick true to the facts, true to the way things really work, you also want to stick as close as you can to the stories that grip us and make us want to turn the next page.
Now, you've been down in Florida for many years, but you keep getting drawn back to Chicago for your novels. Why?
You know, I do. You know, I've written, this is my fourth novel set in Chicago. My previous four are all set in Northeast Florida, the most recent of those being Monument Road. I feel as if I still have a foot in both places. I grew up in Chicago. I'm not sure if I view that as home or if I view this as home. Probably both. It's a wide stance.
I feel the same way. It's very strange.
I was going to say, we've both been here for a long time.
But no matter how long you're here, there's something about that town that you take with you everywhere you go.
There is. You know, I don't think that we can ever leave our past behind, and we can't leave the places where we've lived behind either. They become part of us. They're in our bones. And so, whenever I go back to Chicago, and I do frequently, breathing that air for the first time in say a year or more, is always this kind of strange, it's a full body experience and it's a full mind experience, and writing about the city is the same kind of thing. After four books here, I felt like I needed to spend about a year there thinking and living there imaginatively.
Your books have really captured Northeast Florida, though, too, the culture here. You've done a good job of that as well.
I love writing about this place. I love living here. And my next book, the one that I'm working on right now, will be set back here again. To me, writing about this city, it's not done often enough. And so I love being able to try to bring out the things that I've experienced.
What advice do you have for authors? You're such a prolific author and have seen a lot of success. It's hard to become a published author. What advice do you have?
Every one of us as a writer needs to figure out what she or he needs to do to make things work. For me, the advice is always write, which is to say, write every day. Read the work that you love to read, that you'd like to be able to write something that you can tell a story as well as the person that, you're reading tells it. And then write, even if it's, say, spending a half an hour or 15 minutes or 20 minutes, It's a rare day when I don't write, and sooner or later, the writing accumulates. As with anything that we do, the more practice, the more time mm-hmm. we do it, we're going to learn things. We're going to get better. And so doing that, and then, you know, the next stage is selling one's writing, and boy, that's just as tough as writing well.
How many rejections did you get before you finally got a yes and your first book got published?
I think I stopped counting, right?
Really?
You know, I had already had a background doing freelance writing and things like that opened some doors for me in ways that if I didn't have, they wouldn't have opened as quickly. But I would send out batches of 10 letters to various agents at a time. And probably 70 or 80, maybe more before, you know, I got the first one. And that book didn't sell. And then another 70 before the first of my books did. Don't give up. Don't give up. You know, I view myself as an overnight success at the age of about 43. You know, it takes a while.
Well, you can meet Michael. He has a couple of book signing appearances coming up this week and next. Where are you going to be?
I'm going to be at Chamblin's Uptown on Laura Street. That will be on Wednesday starting at 6:00. We'll be going until about 8:00. And I'll be talking and signing books. And then please come out to the San Marco bookstore in San Marco. I'll be there on Thursday starting at 6:30, running till about 8:00 as well. Can't wait to see you.
It's your chance to meet local author Michael Wiley. Wednesday at Chamblin's, Thursday at San Marco Books and More. They sponsor our monthly book club, which we're very happy about. The new novel is Trouble in Mind. Michael Wiley, always so good to see you, and all the best to you.
It's always so good to see you too, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Well, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back to talk some sports in this first show of the new year. As Cole Pepper looks at the Jaguars coaching staff, they are sticking around for another season. Are you a Jaguars fan? What do you think about that? Pretty controversial. That and some other news and notes from over the weekend in sports coming up in a moment. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
For 25 years, WJCT's radio reading service has been providing daily readings of your local paper, the Florida Times-Union. Perhaps you have blindness or need help reading the paper. You can listen to it being read online at wjct.org/radio reading. Or we'll send you a radio tuned to radio reading service. It's free because radio reading gives voice to the printed word. Call 904-358-6308.
Farrah and Farrah, dedicated to representing the injured people in Jacksonville for over 40 years. Learn more at farrahandfarrah.com or 396-5555. Farrah and Farrah's accident attorneys are here for you, here for good.
The New York Times has praised Stefan Jakiv's remarkable purity of tone, which he couples with the controlled intensity this concerto demands. Happy New Year. I'm Courtney Lewis. Our season-long celebration of Beethoven continues with his violin concerto. The symphony is joined by violin phenom Stefan Jakiv on January 10th and 11th. Tickets and more at jacksymphony.org.
A unique Epiphany celebration takes place in Tarpon Springs during the first week of January. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will explore the traditional Greek culture in Tarpon Springs. We'll discuss the development of Port Tampa Bay and the short but influential life of musician Graham Parsons. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Fed up with all the noise from Washington? Well, maybe it's time to pay more attention to all the reforms coming out of towns and states led by citizens, just like you.
You gotta whack the hornet's nest to drive change in this country. That's what makes America so beautiful. We can do this and not get thrown in prison.
I'm Todd Zwillick. Who's trying to fix what, and how are they getting it done? That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11, right here on 89.9 WJCT.
Culpepper Sports Wrap-Up is brought to you by Farah and Farah.
Welcome back. Well, what's next for the Jaguars after Shad Khan decided to bring back Doug Marrone and Dave Caldwell for another season? Culpepper has some thoughts, naturally. Hey, Happy New Year, Cole. Good morning.
Happy New Year, Melissa. Yeah, it is a bit of a head-scratcher, although we started to hear late in December, mid to late December, that this was the direction that Shad Khan was likely to follow. Mm-hmm. He did let Tom Coughlin go after we talked about the very damaging memo out from the NFL Players Association. However, to stay with Doug Marrone and to Dave Caldwell, after the Jaguars have had back-to-back seasons in which they collapsed down the stretch, they lost double digits during the year, missed the playoffs,
has
not been well received from fans. Let me put it that way.
That's putting it mildly, right?
Yes. So why did Shad Khan make this decision? I'm going to try to crawl into the head of a billionaire, and as a hundredaire, that's difficult for me to do.
But I'll do
not right now. Christmas was a big one.
Yeah, really.
But to discuss what Shad Khan may have been thinking. First and foremost, I think that both Caldwell and Marrone really gave great pitches for themselves, and probably really put a lot of the struggles on Tom Coughlin and the way that he was interacting with the players. I'm reading between the lines from the press conference that they held last week. But I think that when they talk about reassessing how everybody who comes in contact with the players is managed, that's one of the things they're talking about. Having everybody on the same page. Tom Coughlin, certainly old school. We know that.
Yeah.
Doug Marrone has been much more of an adaptive coach where he changes the way that he coaches and the way he interacts. And I think the more he adapted to the quote-unquote modern player, the further away he was getting from Tom Coughlin's philosophy and the more strife there became between the two of them. So I think there were very good cases made by both of them to stick around because Coughlin was such a big personality, had such a so much gravity in the organization. So what will the fallout be? Well, the big question now is going to really be, first and foremost, about two things, and that is season ticket sales and sponsorship sales. The Jaguars, every year in the State of the Franchise address, talk about having to increase local revenues. And this is why they talk about how important the game in London is, because they make millions of dollars on that game alone. Well, if they announce that a second home game is going to be played in London, there has been some rumor about that happening here for 2020. Now you're all of a sudden going to have six home games in Jacksonville. You're going to have a coach and a general manager with a losing record who have been over losing teams the last 2 years. The fans are not going to respond well to this, and they have not already. The thing that sells tickets and sells sponsorships, well, sponsorship can be about value, but the thing that sells tickets is not wins. It's the hope of wins.
Sure.
And right now, you have to, you can find a few things to be hopeful about. If you like Gardner Minshew, you like Josh Allen, the rookie, to see how he's done, DJ Chark, you are individual players. But in the grand scheme, there's not a lot to hang your hat on for hope right now. Now, there are a lot of things that are going to happen here in the next several months that could change that a bit. There are some key offseason dates we should discuss, including the scouting combine, which begins February 24th. Shortly thereafter, the Jaguars can begin to put the franchise tag on a player. Yannick Ngakoue is the guy I'm thinking of here. If Ngakoue doesn't want to sign a contract with the Jaguars, they can compel him to stay in Jacksonville for a year and pay him the average of the top five highest paid defensive ends in the league. But he doesn't have to sign it, and he doesn't have to play. He can say to heck with it and do what Telvin Smith did and sit out a year. We're not sure what Telvin's going to do, by the way, going forward. Free agency begins March the 18th, and the Jaguars will have a chance to sign some. But they're going to lose some very recognizable players to the salary cap. Most notably, Marcel Darius and A.J. Boye. Calais Campbell could also be a salary cap casualty, potentially, which would be a big loss in that locker room.
It's a lot of talent walking out the door.
No doubt about it. And so things are going to change quite a bit. Of course, the NFL draft comes up on April 23rd through 25th. So over the course of February, March, and April, you're going to see a lot of these big changes happening that sort of set the roster for the future. And if they're going to sell hope in 2020 to the fans, something major is going to have to happen in that time frame. Then, of course, there's the quarterback situation. What are they going to do with Nick Foles, and are they going to go in with Gardner Minshew?
What do you think?
Well, I think it's going to be tough for the Jaguars to they can't cut Foles because the salary cap implications are too dire. I think they will be shopping him to try to find a willing trade partner who's also willing to take a bunch of that salary, so the salary cap hit isn't as penal as it could be potentially. One team to look out for, by the way, is the Colts, where Frank Reich was Foles' offensive coordinator in Philadelphia. He's now the head coach of the Colts. But I think the odds-on favorite is that both Minshew and Foles go into the offseason as 1 and 1A, and there's a quarterback competition in the offseason and maybe up through training camp, and then may the best man win. I still think that Nick Foles can be much better than he showed in a Jaguars uniform. As long as both the collarbone is healed and his psyche is healed, because it certainly was not the same guy we saw lead the Eagles to the Super Bowl a couple of years ago.
Yeah. And at least with such a dismal season, at least Minshew gave the fans a little gold starry dust.
Yeah,
and a little excitement.
Yeah, and he also was kind of got the short end of the stick when the NFL announced their fan vote rookie of the year candidates. He was not included. Neither was Josh Allen, who led all rookies in sacks this year. So the Jaguars, again, getting short shrift from the national media.
Getting the short shrift.
Yep.
It's never going to change, is it? But it's always good to count on Cole every Monday at 9 on our show to talk sports. Happy New Year, my friend, and thank you for being here as always. Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you. That's our show. Thanks so much for listening. And if you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll connect with you again tomorrow at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.